It's Philosophy Talk.
We like to call this the catch-22 of virtual reality. On the one hand, anyone can do whatever they want beyond our wildest dreams. On the other hand, we're programmed biologically just treat it as real.
I think, therefore, I am a virtual self.
I can build a version of you that looks just like you.
Why settle for your boring old real-world identity?
We can change our height, we can change our weight, we can change the way that our faces look, we can change our patterns of speech, we can project an optimal self.
Will virtual reality someday supplant real reality?
Our guest is Jeremy Balinson, director of Stanford's Virtual Human Interaction Lab.
Humans have not evolved to differentiate virtual things from real things, to think that fake people aren't people.
Digital selves, avatars, Second Life, and virtual reality.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk after the news.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Today, we've taken Philosophy Talk just down the road. We're recording the program in front of a live audience at The Marsh, San Francisco's breeding ground for new performance.
Our thinking originated at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, but we're really excited to be here at The Marsh in San Francisco and meet in person some of our listeners who live right here. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Our topic today is digital selves, avatars, Second Life, and virtual reality.
Now, Ken, a digital self isn't a person made out of numbers or fingers, you know. It's a computerized representation of a person. It can be a VRS, a virtual representation of self, or a VRO, a virtual representation of another person.
Okay, so let me see if I've got this straight. So you've got me. I'm a real person. And then there are representations of me. My name in the paper, my image in a mirror, the picture of me on our website, or even my idea of myself in my own head, or maybe your idea of me in your head.
That's right. My idea of you is a VRO, and my idea of me is a VRS. I mean, I see my name in the phone book or in the Stanford catalog. I hear myself talking when I listen to Philosophy Talk. I see myself or a representation of myself when I watch a video of my grandchild's last birthday party. I can see myself in the mirror.
And in all those ways, I can also have representations of others. But here's a question. Now, what's special about the digital representations?
Well, lots of things. Now, for one thing, given today's technology, they can be very lifelike. If you go into Jeremy Balinson's virtual reality lab at Stanford and put on some goggles, you can meet people that look and talk pretty much like real people, although they are actually just digital representations.
Right, and then you can also have like avatars, and that's a representation of a real person that appears in these immersive communities and games and stuff like Second Life and interacts with other avatars.
Right, and all the digital representations we've mentioned have something very important in common. They can be programmed to behave. They don't just sit there and smile back at you like yourself in a mirror. They can be programmed to behave in what seems like a sort of autonomous way. So they're not like a photo or a video recording or much less like a piece of language like my name in a book. I can set up my avatar to be me, but be a different me, to be less responsible than I am, to live a wilder virtual life than I would dare live in real life.
Yeah, you know, that's all pretty exciting stuff, especially the part about a less responsible you. Well, I'm not sure that's possible, John, but this is all exciting and cool. But what's philosophical about it? What's it got to do with philosophy?
Well, one interesting thing is what virtual reality experiments can tell us about belief, perception, and emotion and how they interact. When you enter a virtual world voluntarily, like Balinson's lab, you know that you're in a plain old room without a bottomless pit to fall into, snakes to attack you, or other persons to bump into. But when he creates these virtual representations in your mind through these goggles, these beliefs about what the world you're in is really like don't block your emotional and visceral reactions to the virtual world. You're scared of stepping into the bottomless pit in the virtual room, even though you feel a solid floor beneath your feet.
I guess that's why they're immersive, right? You're totally immersed in this other reality. And I guess another thing is this. It all seems to hold promise for, you know, something deeply philosophical. Philosophical thought experiments might actually come true. I mean, how do I know whether I'm Ken Taylor at the Marsh or Ken Taylor with goggles? Maybe goggles so small I can't feel them in a virtual Marsh. I mean, Descartes would have loved it, man. We could prove the existence of a virtual god or at least a beneficent webmaster.
Well, and the deepest philosophical question of all, how much would it matter? If the interplay of representations in your mind is makes you happy, does it matter if they're caused by a real world or not? Is reality that important?
Luckily, you know, we have the very man whose lab you mentioned, Jeremy Bailenson, director of the Human Virtual Interaction Lab at Stanford, to help us think through some of these thorny philosophical issues.
Here's the plan. We'll begin by discussing some interesting properties of virtual environments, especially what the researchers in that area call presence. Now, they don't mean Christmas presence. They mean, like, presence in the sense that something's present, that when you're in this room with these virtual images, you feel like real things are present with you.
It's what Heidegger called Dasein,
being there. Exactly.
Then we'll consider the nature of social interactions in virtual reality and how they can influence social interactions in real life.
Finally, we'll consider some applications of virtual reality in the physical world. It can change our lives, but for the better or for the worse.
But first, our roving philosophical reporter, Zoe Corneli, takes us on a real-world tour of a virtual reality lab. She files this report.
I wanted to experience virtual reality firsthand to see just how real it is. So I headed down to the Virtual Human Interaction Lab at Stanford University, run by Jeremy Bailenson.
Hi, good to meet you.
Hey, Jeremy. Thanks for having us down here today.
Thank you. Thanks for coming.
So what exactly is it that you guys do here?
What we do is we build immersive virtual reality simulations, which are digital worlds that perceptually envelop a user. We then take people, put them inside of VR, and experiment on how their identity changes, how social interaction changes, basically how the human condition changes when you're virtual compared to when you're physical.
So can you tell me an interesting example of how an experience of virtual reality could change real reality?
I think you're about to see some very compelling examples of the idea we call presence, which is feeling like you're in a virtual space and forgetting you're in a physical space. We say VR demos like 1,000 pictures, so I think you're about to see firsthand how you can confuse the real with the virtual.
Graduate student Catherine Segovia shows me what they call the head-mounted display, a hefty set of goggles perched on a styrofoam head. A small blue light extends from the top like the lure of a deep-sea anglerfish.
This is the light that it tracks. It tracks the user on an X, a Y, and then a Z plane, so that we can track your movement in every movement that you make.
So can I try it on?
Yes, of course.
I step into a big, dark, empty room. This is where I'll experience the virtual world. A camera in each of the four corners will track my movements, and the computer will adjust what I see accordingly. Undergraduate Nicole Fernandez explains the world I'm about to enter.
In your virtual world, you'll be in the lab office, but in the middle of the office on the floor, there's going to be a huge pit with a plank overlooking it.
Oh, no!
And your job is to cross the plank, and the purpose of this demo is supposed to possibly help people who have fears of heights and things like that. And
what about people who don't have fears of heights but are about to get one?
Well, you are in the room now.
Oh, wow, it looks pretty real.
Suddenly, I'm in a lighter, crisper version of the office. There are photos on the walls. The surfaces have realistic textures. Then I look down.
Oh, my God!
If you look to the door again, you'll see avatars come in.
Oh, are they nice?
Yeah.
They are nice.
People march into the room periodically and jump directly into the pit, where they land with a splat.
Oh, my God! Mm-hmm. And this is supposed to make me less scared?
This is supposed to get you more immersed into the world.
Okay, so I'm supposed to walk across this?
Walk across,
that's correct. I'm scared, okay.
I start to walk across. It's a bit odd that I can't feel the plank under my feet, but somehow I'm still scared of falling off.
Okay, scary. Here I go.
It looks like I've just about made it across when...
Whoa! I fell!
Luckily, you can start again. This time, I take very small steps and make it across.
Woo! I did it! Yeah, take that. Okay.
Coming out of the virtual world, I feel a little queasy. Fortunately, the lab has ginger ale available for moments like these. Virtual reality felt real enough, but it's nice to be back in the world I'm used to. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Zoe Corneli.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk, coming to you from the Marsh Theater in San Francisco. I'm John Perry. Along with me is Ken Taylor.
And we're joined now by Jeremy Bailenson. He's a professor of communications at Stanford University, director of the Virtual Human Interaction Lab. Jeremy, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you, Ken.
So, Jeremy, I mean, how did you get interested in virtual reality? I mean, do you have some aversion to ordinary reality, some kind of deep problem with it or something?
Thank you for that wonderful introduction there, John. As always, a pleasure talking to you. To be honest, I was reading a lot of science fiction, and I thought, we can actually do this stuff now.
Cyberpunk type stuff?
A lot of cyberpunk.
Who are the big authors we should read or should avoid in that area?
I think you should read Neuromancer by William Gibson.
William Gibson, that's
absolutely.
Kind of the Bible of the field.
I believe so.
Now, in these novels, things we aren't quite ready to do yet happen, right? I mean, like, people can kind of channel each other's minds and channel the minds of people who are dead and have been somehow kept on tape. Do you expect to do all that kind of stuff in your lifetime?
Well, I can look at a digital photo of a dead person now. Mm-hmm. Now we've got avatars that are more realistic on things like Second Life and Facebook. Those aren't going anywhere. Digital stuff doesn't die. 10 years from now, it's going to be extremely lifelike, the digital version that I have. So, yes.
10 years from now, it may be more lifelike than I am 10 years from now. So
I'm going to leave that one alone.
So, what are the big important things to say about the representation of self and others in virtual reality as it stands now and as you hope it to be?
I think you really hit the nail on the head earlier, which is I can build a version of you that looks just like you. It gestures like you. It's got your facial structure. It moves its arms like you. It smiles like you. It is very much like you. Mm-hmm. Now, two big points about this. One, it's going to live forever. Ones and zeros don't degrade like a phonograph does. They'll be around for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years as long as there's electricity. The second is it's animatable. So 200 years from now, this version of John, which looks just like John, I can make it sit on your grandson's lap and say hello and tell it a story. Or any whim that I have in terms of animating it to do any behavior, we can do that. So you'll be around forever, and anyone can make you do whatever they want.
Okay, so that's a cool thing, I think. Or maybe it's a frightening thing. I'm not sure. But, I mean, why do we want that? I mean, what's the big deal about our being able to do that?
Well, living forever has been a human goal.
Well, that's true. But, I mean, but John won't really live forever. His avatar, you know. But
from the point of view of his loved ones, he will be around. And I think that's the key distinction. So John won't have consciousness, but his buddies will be able to experience him as if he did.
Okay, let's not talk about after John's dead. Let's talk about while he's alive. Mm-hmm. Okay. He's a professor at Stanford. Is there any big deal for him as a professor at Stanford to have an avatar that can look like him? Would his students prefer the avatar to him?
Let's not pick on John. Let's talk about Jeremy for a second.
Okay,
I could build an avatar of myself that is about five times the teacher that I am.
Five times the teacher that you
five
are?
Five or six, we'll say.
Yeah, I know you're an amazing teacher, actually. I've heard about you.
Well, thank you.
But really, why? Why would he be five or six times the teacher?
A virtual teacher never loses patience, so the little slips that I might make in front of this crowd, we can put a filter on my avatar so that I never curse, that I never break eye contact, that I hang on your every word.
If you had a virtual doctor, would they never lose patience?
So
I'm sorry. He was on the roll. Go ahead.
This technology is going to improve the way we present ourselves to others.
That's a loaded question, and it's certainly going to change it. For better or for worse, the digital revolution has really encapsulated us all at this point. So it's here. We love online digital interaction. Whether it's going to be better or worse, there's good things and there's bad things.
So a lot of life is self-presentation, right? And self-representation and all that. we present ourselves to others in all kinds of contexts. And you're saying this can really, really affect in a major way the way we present ourselves.
The big difference between VR and the physical world is right now I can only project a single Jeremy to this audience. It could be the case that half of these people like a smiling Jeremy, half of them like a serious Jeremy. In VR, I can send different versions of me to different people.
Wow. This is a special edition of Philosophy Talk, coming to you from the Marsh Theater in San Francisco. We're talking about digital selves, avatars, and virtual reality with our guest, Jeremy Baylinson.
We've been learning about the representation of selves in virtual reality. Next, we'll consider social interactions in virtual reality and what they can tell us and how they can affect social interactions in real life.
Do you go online and have an alternative online self? Present it to us. Tell us about it. Plus comments and questions from our live audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Hey, hey, I want to be an avatar. Hey, hey, I want
to
be an avatar.
We're here at the Marsh Theater in San Francisco. Welcome back to Philosophy Talk. Avatars, Second Life, and virtual reality. That's our topic on Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Jeremy Baylinson, director of Stanford's Virtual Human Interaction Lab.
So, Jeremy, let's suppose I have an avatar, and I'm not just interested in an avatar that's a better teacher than me and can keep eye contact. I'm into Second Life or something similar, and I have an avatar that is flirtatious, confident, aggressive, kind of not very much like me, more like Ken, right? But but looks like me. Now, if I play a lot of Second Life with that avatar going around and talking to other avatars, will that have an effect on me? Will that feed back into real life?
Absolutely. So with an avatar, if you take the notion of dress for success, you can take this to the most ridiculous levels. We can change our height. We can change our weight. We can change the way that our faces look. We can change our patterns of speech. We can project an optimal self. Mm-hmm. What we've shown in the lab is if you stick someone in an avatar that's good looking, they behave more confidently. They behave more social.
While they're in that avatar or in their whole life?
We haven't tested anyone for their whole life yet, Ken. But,
I don't mean over the course of their entire life. I mean outside that context of that.
Thus far, we've shown changes in three separate studies, one for an hour later. So if I put you in a beautiful avatar and then lead you across the hall, pay you for your study, and say, look, you've got time to set up an online dating site, you'll pick better-looking people face-to-face because you've got this confidence that carries over. In other studies, we've shown that it lasts up to 24 hours later. So if I show you your avatar working out and your avatar loses weight, you'll exercise more 24 hours later.
Wow. So, I mean, it's like I become what I represent. So I represent this what I want to be, and then I play this immersive thing, and then I become more like what I want to be?
There's a famous psychological theory called self-perception theory, and it explains why the Raiders are the most penalized football team in the league, because they look towards their kind of pirate dark uniform and then fulfill that prophecy by actually acting more aggressive because of how they're dressed.
So this seems to open up lots of opportunities for good and abusive uses. I mean, we could, instead of virtual reality just being a thing that kids play for fun, we could start using all kinds of nefarious educational programming and suck kids into being more obedient and getting their homework done because we've programmed that into their avatars. I guess that might be a good thing.
You know, any technology can be used for good or bad. And I think the story is as simple as that. There's bad things about TV. There's bad things about... No, there's no bad things about radio, is there?
I'm wondering. Yeah. I mean, is it really... I'm a little puzzled, really. It's just puzzling. You think, I am a certain way, right? Mm-hmm. Pretending to be some other way doesn't make me different from what I am. I mean, can I overcome my shyness by pretending to be confident?
Let me ask you this. What's going on? Why did you wear a tie this evening?
Because it's part of the way I present myself in front of people who, you know.
So the question is, are you behaving a tiny bit more confidently because you know that you're dressed quite sharply? And that is a great tie, by the way.
Well, thank you. Okay, suppose I'm wearing this tie, I behave a little more confidently. because I'm wearing this tie, because I present myself a certain
way. The effects are subtle, and we're not even aware that they happen. But what the data shows, both in face-to-face in terms of how you dress and in virtual reality and with how your avatar looks, is we conform to the physical appearances. The really shallow surface stuff makes a difference.
Right. Great idea. I mean, we could produce avatars that instead of just being better looking or more flirtatious, were much more knowledgeable or had better judgment. We could require each president or vice president. we could require each of them to have an avatar that had all the knowledge and wisdom that could, and we couldn't say you have to do what your avatar does, but you have to consult with your avatar.
Yeah.
Do you see kind of applications like that?
Natural language processing is what we call when you try to generate language on the fly. Mm-hmm. It's really hard, and one of the reasons I do visual stuff is
easy for you to say.
it's much more difficult to do AI that can actually speak than it is to look away.
So let me ask you a question about the AI. An avatar, I've never really played with one of these. And you said philosophers know what they are, but I'm not really sure I got it completely. So I have these representations. Does my avatar, or can my avatar have a knowledge base that's separate from mine? You know, saying you can you tie up this representation with a bunch of knowledge that maybe I don't have, and then interact with it?
So it depends on how you call an avatar. So right now people have these profiles on things like Facebook or MySpace and a web page. One can argue that's got some of your history and your knowledge, and that exists autonomously from you. In terms of the things on Second Life and the things that we have in the lab, you can put basic areas, but as I said, it's really hard to make a thinking being right now.
So basically, though, so my avatar... interacting with other avatars is me interacting with them through this medium, right?
We've built what we call an autopilot. So imagine you're in a business meeting and it's really boring. In a video conference, you can't duck out because they see you. But in VR, you can hit the button, and we've built the autopilot to have your accent, to have use the same kind of verbs that you use, to have your gestures. So we like using that during meetings.
Now, I would go the opposite direction. So, I mean, one thing about meetings I've noticed, and this isn't new, I mean, women have known it for years, is that the older, white-haired, deep-voiced man, whether he has nothing to say or not, will say a lot and be taken very seriously. Mm-hmm. While the more intelligent a woman, especially if she's younger, has a high-pitched voice, won't be. Now, it seems to me in a video meeting, you want the chairman, a wise chairman, to pick the avatars, right? So if he thinks the old fart, is that okay? A male professor is going to hog the whole meeting with a bunch of blather about the way it was in the 50s. But everybody's going to be very impressed by what he says. He should assign her a kind of, you know, a Valley Girl type avatar, and he'll just be frustrated. The young woman who always has good points but's never paid any attention to, he should get... Do you see the possibility of that use of avatars?
Yeah, so here's where we can make it even more complicated. So now let's pretend that you're in your virtual meeting and you think you look just like you are with you're the dashing older man. However, somebody blocks that on their end and they see you as the less experienced, not aged, wise one, but as a child. So the world gets even more complicated that you can think you look A, but everyone else sees you as B.
And you don't know how they're seeing you.
You have no idea. Computers all draw the VR world separately.
So wait a minute then. So this means social interaction in a virtual world can be really, really complicated and interesting. And I mean, it can be because a lot of that stuff is cues that we give each other unconsciously about whose turn it is, who's dominant, all that stuff can be.
Yeah, William Gibson calls this the infinite plasticity of the digital, in the sense that it just regresses because what you see is not necessarily what you get, and this expands and goes on and on.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're at the Marsh Theater, San Francisco's breeding ground for new performance, in front of a live audience, and we've got questions from that live audience now. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Yeah, thank you very much. My name is Bill Allard. I'm from San Francisco. What's the arguments against this? People argued against comic books. People argue against television. What is the struggle for this? What are people saying? Is Second Life being attacked by any organizations? Take my question off the air.
I'll attack it. why do we want this? I mean, why is this going to make the world better? I mean, we've got devices for dealing with the real world. They work pretty well. You're going to undermine those devices, so we won't really know in these virtual meetings who we're talking to, or you're undermining the things we take for granted and thus making life harder. And probably you're being paid by our tax money to do this. Well, why should we be doing that?
We're getting paid for this talk? A few areas of attack we come under as VR researchers. The most obvious one is if our kids are online all the time, they never go outside. Mm-hmm. And the data actually doesn't speak towards that. People that play video games tend to like games and actually go outside more with the very limited data that's out there. I actually don't believe we should all be in VR. I don't play games like Second Life. I don't play video games. So I'm trying to be... I actually have no paradigm one way or the other. An additional area of criticism we come under is video game violence. A lot of literature by a lot of important people saying that video games are causing people to go out and hurt people. So those are probably the two main areas.
I bet you, I don't know, but I'm willing to wager that the forms of pornographic representation in these virtual communities... People must be exploring their imaginations.
We just ran the first longitudinal ethnography in this world called Second Life, which is an online virtual world. 80 Stanford students spent 10 hours a week for a month and a half in Second Life. And the conservative estimate, you know, we hear all about how Second Life is a breeding ground for democracy and brilliant areas for participation and all sorts of political rallies. The conservative estimate is about 85% to 90% adult activities.
Oh, so we've got more questions from our live audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hi, this is Tom. My question has to do similarly to the violence. Other criminality. Criminality is always social. So, what is a virtual crime? How would you prosecute a virtual crime? Crimes, identity theft. Crimes against trust, those are some of the things that I would be interested in.
Well, there are scholars who dedicate their career towards understanding that stuff. And there's two types of crimes. There's the crimes that could occur in the face-to-face world, like beating someone up, that can happen in the virtual world. And that's the really tough one, because we don't really know how to deal with that philosophically. The other ones, things like identity theft, that we know how to deal with, because that's just fraud.
But is it really fraud? Because I now have, like, the VRO or the VRS, is it just a different version, or is it the computer and the projection that's going on there?
Well, Second Life has a currency. They're called Linden dollars. And if somebody fraudulates your Linden doll, is fraudulate a word?
Probably not, yeah. But it is now.
If somebody steals your Linden dollars... you can actually go to Amazon and sell your Linden dollars.
See, so this raises a really fascinating stuff, because some of the stuff in something like Second Life or these virtual encounters more generally is, you know, virtual crime, as it were. And some of it, I mean, you're interacting with a real person on the end, ultimately, and some of it is an offense against the real person over there. Mm-hmm. And trying to rethink all this and recategorize this, it seems to me kind of like a Brave New World kind of thing, potentially.
Right. It's a good thing lawyers outnumber plumbers 5-1, huh?
Yeah. We've got lots of questions on this side of the room. I'll go back and forth between the two sides of the room.
My name is Cole. I'm just wondering, in what sense is a virtual place a real place? Because it seems like there's some kind of obvious sense in which it's not real. It's not made out of molecules. It's made out of whatever, ones and zeros. But it seems like I can say things about virtual places, like... You showed the example of the pit room earlier. I can say, I'm scared in this pit room. And some people have said that if you can predicate something like I'm scared of a thing, then there's a real thing there. So I'm wondering what you guys think about this.
So just before maybe Jeremy gives an intro, I'll just interject an observation watching the growth of this field over the last 20 years. It used to be the vocabulary of virtual reality versus reality. Mm-hmm. So there's kind of this reality and there's this stuff that isn't reality. But now I notice researchers in the field more tend to talk about worlds, the virtual world and the physical world. So in terms of being real, they're on a par. There's one's physical, one's virtual. So fess up. How do you think of this?
Well, let's talk as if we are perceptual psychologists, meaning studying how the eyes and the ears work. Perception is active, mm-hmm. meaning when I see this room over here, I'm doing all sorts of translation with distance and size, and you see these people a different distance than I do. You see them as different colors than I do. So there is no one objective thing that we are perceiving. So take for one example that there's no such thing as one object reality. My mentor, Jim Blaskovich, in this field hates the word virtual reality because it implies that it's not real. So now we use immersive virtual environments is what we try to say. I still use VR.
Well, especially if it's a space where people interact with other people to do human things, you know, to offend each other, to delight each other, to trade with each other. Then it's real. I mean, social, it's a real social space, right?
I mean, this is actually not new about VR. So how many times do you yell at a referee on the television? Or do you look at your phone really angry at the phone because you think it's the other person when in fact it's just...
But the referee doesn't hear me yell and doesn't yell back. It doesn't say, hey, buddy, shut up. He doesn't do that, right?
I don't think so, no.
Yeah, but, somebody's confused if they go to London and try to find where Sherlock Holmes lived. Even, it's 22 Baker Street, but there is no 22 Baker Street. And if they're confused by that, they're not quite getting the fact that when they read a novel, it's not, with all due respect to your professor, real.
Right.
Now, it's a lot more like experiencing the real to be in the position Zoe was in, but still, that pit isn't real. As a philosopher, I would pound on a table.
You love reality. It keeps you in business. We've got more questions here.
Hello. Eric Lifshitz, attorney in San Francisco, and on behalf of attorneys, you know, there's never enough of us. There are never enough people who have more rights that need to be defended. In any event, I was curious about the idea that you're creating these shells where, you know, a person that looks just like someone you know, and that they are kind of a vessel which has an ability to then be taking in all this information. And my question was, what is the next types of information that should be being collected that ultimately will allow that vessel that someone you may know can then utilize that information to become more like that person?
Right now, if I videotaped you during that one-minute speech, I could have my software glean about 95% of how your face moves. I can, from two angles, I could build your head so it looks exactly real. We have the technology to make these things feel just like you right now.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing digital selves, avatars, Second Life, and virtual reality with Jeremy Bailenson, director of the Virtual Human Interaction Lab at Stanford University.
We've been comparing interactions in virtual reality, so to speak, with those in real life, so to speak. Next, what difference does it make? Can virtual life improve real life? Does it really make any difference if you travel to the rainforest or if you just go down to Stanford and have the virtual experience of traveling to the rainforest? Does it really make any difference if you have a girlfriend that you'll probably have to get married to and be linked to for 40 or 50 years? Why not just have a virtual girlfriend that, you know, eventually you can unplug?
Well, we're coming to you from the Mars, San Francisco's breeding ground for new performance. We'll take more questions from our live audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
We're here doing Philosophy Talk at the Marsh Theater in San Francisco. Welcome back. If you had a robotic or a virtual boyfriend or girlfriend to satisfy your every need, would that be a good thing? I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're discussing digital cells with Jeremy Bailenson from Stanford University. Jeremy, so look, it seems to me that this kind of technology opens up all kinds of possibilities for new social interaction. And part of me thinks, well, yay, because like the telephone opened up new possibilities and you know, the computer itself opened up new possibilities. But when I hear some of it, the pornography, the new ways of doing crime, I think, yeah. Unbalanced. You think this is a great thing, a mediocre thing? It's not going to have much effect. You're in this field.
I think
let your imagination run wild.
I think it's a thing, and it's going to be horrible for some ways, and it's going to be fantastic in others.
Tell me some ways in which it's going to be horrible, and some ways in which it's going to be fantastic.
Okay, let's go back to John's earlier point, which is what can you do with a significant other? So let's pretend that John had met some woman and they'd had a relationship, and he had enough photographs and audio clips that he could build her avatar. Okay, his girlfriend could break up with him physically, but he would have the virtual version of her forever. so she never really could break up with him.
That sounds sick.
It's a bad thing. It is not a good thing. You asked me for me to come up with some horrible things.
Okay, so tell me a great application.
Many great applications. So we're doing work with the Federal Judicial Center about a better way to do police lineups. So lots of innocent people go to jail because police lineups, where a witness looks at versions of suspects, are done from photographs, which are two-dimensional, taken from a single angle, which we call bad VR. So if you make these things three-dimensional, give people more information, it's a better way to conduct the lineups. We're showing you get fewer false alarms, meaning fewer people get sent to jail because of witnesses who are overconfident based on looking at poor information.
Right, right. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about digital cells, virtual reality, avatars, and Second Life with our guest Jeremy Bailenson at the Mars Theater. We have lots of questioners in our live audience, and I'll go to this side of the room. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hello, I'm Karen from San Francisco, and I have a question for John and Ken. Have you heard anything tonight that has challenged your notions of truth and falsehood or anything that would help you investigate these questions?
I would say I haven't heard anything that challenges my notions of truth and falsehood, but I have heard things that would help me investigate them because, we are able to take this world that Zoe was in, a world in which there's a flat surface, a young lady with goggles on, and we don't have any trouble at all completely redescribing it as a much different situation based on what she seems to see and what we know she seems to see. So ordinary language is incredibly flexible. We can use it to construct novels. We can use it to describe virtual worlds. We can use it to lie. We can use it to cheat. So every time we do that, to me, it's interesting because it shows the flexibility of language. But ultimately, I guess because I'm what philosophers called a realist or maybe just not very imaginative, but no, it doesn't challenge the distinction between reality and non-reality. It just challenges our ability to explain it clearly.
Well, see, I think that virtual reality, as if it's not real reality, is in a way okay, but also it's a misnomer, and I share your mentors. Because I think one of the things that goes on is that through this technology, we can create new social spaces that are real social spaces that are just constituted in a brand new way. And I actually think it's really fascinating what we will eventually do with the creation of social spaces with this.
But I mean, aren't social spaces like counterfeit money? I mean, is there a longitude and a latitude to a social space?
No, that's why they're real, because social spaces don't have to have a longitude and a latitude. What do you think, Jeremy?
One of the greatest examples of that kind of breaks this definition is when you're having a mirror conversation. So in the morning, you have your wife or husband standing next to you, and you're looking at the mirror having a conversation to the mirror image, which is not a person, and you don't blink and treating this person just as if they were a real person. In this sense, VR, we're very good at treating mediated things as real. We haven't evolved to think that fake people aren't people.
You know, human beings are basically designed for face-to-face communication, right? Of course, we have learned to communicate at a distance over telephones and all that sort of stuff, but this virtual reality technology, I mean, is really exploding ways of communicating that don't have do with face-to-face communication. And I wonder how we do it. I mean, you know, the ordinary cues aren't there and all that stuff. I mean, is there much research on that?
We like to call this the catch-22 of virtual reality. So humans have not evolved to differentiate virtual things from real things. If it looks like a person, it's probably a person. On the other hand, in VR, you can do anything. You can have 40 selves. Your selves can evolve faster than one could even fathom. You can look however you want. So on the one hand, anyone can do whatever they want beyond our wildest dreams. On the other hand, we're programmed biologically just treat it as real. So it's a difficult time.
Yeah. Well, human beings are amazingly flexible. I mean, if you think about the telephone, think about spoken language, written language, the telegraph, the telephone, each one changes the nature of the interaction. And in a way, virtual reality brings it much more back to the original in terms of we pick up visual cues and it's a real-time relation as opposed to written language and so forth and so on. The human being's an amazingly flexible cognitive being, so who knows?
Yeah. We've got more questions at this side of the room.
Hello. I was wondering, how long do you think it'll be before there is virtual reality anonymous, a need to, you can see where that's going, and will they be able to do that in a VR environment?
Well, there is a lot of research on internet addiction right now, actually a very popular research topic. So, and a lot of research on video games, which is kind of like VR. So there are people researching that. And your intuitions are quite good in that VR is used a lot right now for treating phobias, things like being afraid to fly or fear of public speaking. We've got a world where I can take the audience, and as you're speaking wearing the goggles, you see these people just like I'm seeing now. As I turn the dial to the right, they smile and nod at your every word. As I turn it to the left, they stare at you and scream out, "You suck!" And it's a really, can I say that?
Yeah. We'll edit it.
Okay. And it is an extremely powerful, really difficult thing to speak to an audience who's looking at you, shaking their head, and frowning at you, and looking at their watches and yawning. So a lot of people using it for phobia. I love the circularity of the treating it for internet addiction.
But you're just describing undergraduate teaching.
But Ajit, can I follow up with? I was just wondering if I could follow up because it seems to me that in the middle of that question, I'm trying to get at something, and I'd be happy to hear from the philosophers about this too. We don't need a program to get us over the addiction to reality. It seems like in this program, we've pretty quickly got into this idea that virtual reality and reality are indistinguishable, and yet. It seems like you're in the middle. I mean, trying to get at something now, which distinguishes them.
Now, you say we don't need a program to get us over an addiction to reality. But one of the things you could think about, we do have all sorts of things that enable us to escape from reality, right? I mean, and maybe that's one of the things that you might think is bad about virtual reality, that it can turn into this escapist thing. But, you know, reality isn't always pleasant. It often sucks. So, you know. Stuff that gives you new modes of being and representing and interaction with other beings.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
We do take a lot of measures to wean children off of too much dependence on reality and get them into various kinds of non-reality, namely teaching them to read. Not letting them go out on sunny days, making them stay in and read about Huckleberry Finn being out on a sunny day. I don't know. There's no reading 12-point. Program is
well,
there.
The point about the mixing of the virtual and the real is a good one going the other way. So there's great work on treating pain. So for burn victims, if you put them in the VR and show them an ice world that's very cold and frosty and snowy with snowman, it actually reduces their pain. So the presence in the virtual world works as absence in the physical world and actually causes significantly less pain and allows people to heal better.
We've got time for one last question on this side of the room.
Hi, I'm just interested in, I see kind of an analog between dream states and virtual reality, and I think philosopher H.H. Price had a lot to say about that in his, what he called the idea of another world, where he talked about the afterlife even being related to some type of dream states we have, and he made an analogy there that there is something that is real about that, in the sense that we have perceptions in our dream states. We have tactile perceptions, and we seem to have even spatial perceptions in that state, even though they're not materially present. And so it seems to be there's some type of connection there, and I'm just curious to see what you guys would have to say about that.
Well, in philosophy, there's kind of two attitudes towards the connection between perception and the external world. One is the common sense one, perception's in the head. It's the effects of the external world. You could conceivably have the same effects and much different causes, and that's illusion. The other view is idealism, and says, no, the whole world is what occurs in the head, or what you call occurring in the head. But what makes it real is that it's coherent. The unreal is that which doesn't fit. That's why dreams are unreal, is because when you wake up in the morning, they don't fit. But if they did, there's no ultimate difference. And I think if you have that second view, then virtual reality seems like, well, maybe it's not non-reality, but a new way of creating coherence, which is to say a new way of creating reality.
Jeremy, I'll give you one last comment on that or whatever you want.
Real quickly, whenever I think my research is new, I always go back to ideas like that. We've been doing this for as long as we've had thought, we've had dreams and hallucinations, and it's really not that new on the fundamental level.
Well, on that note, Jeremy, I'm going to thank you for joining us. It's been a really fascinating conversation.
Thank you.
Our guest has been Professor Jeremy Bailenson of the Communications Department at Stanford University. He's director of the Virtual Human Interaction Lab there.
We also want to thank every single one in our live audience for participating in the program. Now, give yourselves a really loud round of applause, scream, and yell.
So, John, what did you learn today?
Well, I learned a lot. I mean, valence is fascinating. One question we didn't get to that we'll have to return sometime is, goes right back to the beginning. Who owns these virtual beings that our lives are turned into? Do I have any say over what use the virtual John Perry that someone may come up with is put to?
Yeah,
interesting question.
And can you bequeath them to your heirs and say, you know, this is why I think that's
or prevent your heirs from, you know.
Yeah. Right. So the one thing you can't have is my avatar.
Yeah.
You can have my money, but not my avatar. No, I think this is a fascinating topic, and I think it's all kinds of social. There's all kinds of possibilities, and the thing that fascinates me about it isn't the sort of appearance reality stuff and all that. It's the new possibilities for social interaction. Because I think human beings are social creatures that form societies in all kinds of different ways. And this is just a new tool for forming social groups. And I think it's really cool. But, you know, this conversation continues, as always, on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog.
And you can download podcasts of our program from our website as well. For the final word on virtual reality, we turn to the analog self of Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, a new game shipped in 2008 called Spore. Players can evolve from single-cell organisms to gods traveling through space. Spore offers a creature creator which allows users to virtually create life. When a free version was released last summer, the East Bay Express said, quote, hundreds of thousands of people downloaded the tool and uploaded creatures to the Sporopedia, the game's online encyclopedia. Creatures flooded the servers at a rate of 6 per second, unquote. As the geeks say, cool. But there is a downside. Already, some have used the creature creator from Spore to make giant walking penises. These folks are immediately dubbed spornographers. The internet has trolls, you see. They don't want to play the game. They want to ruin yours. When John Edwards opened a virtual campaign headquarters on the massive game Second Life, trolls, called griefers by Second Lifers, covered it with virtual excrement. When a Second Lifer would earn more than $1 million Linden dollars, as SL currency is called, was interviewed in SL by CNET, the virtual chat was interrupted by floating penises dancing across the stage. Why do trolls do it? For what they call lols, a corruption of the texting shorthand LOL, laughing out loud. One anonymous troll told the New York Times, quote, you look for someone who is full of it, a real blowhard. Then you exploit their insecurities to get an insane amount of drama, laughs, and lulls, unquote. A troll who calls himself Weave told the Times, quote, trolling is basically internet eugenics. I want everyone off the internet. We need to put these people in the oven, unquote. Harsh words. On the other hand, I recently discovered that a popular activity on Second Life is watching movies. A blogger informed me that SLers, quote, rent movies from the companies offering either one-time purchase or rental of movies. I used to rent movies for a while on my Coney Island replica, but griefing was the issue, unquote. So you create your own Coney Island replica in Second Life, your own house, your own living room, your own television, your own avatar, and invite other avatars over for a movie. In Meat World, of course, you're really alone on your hovel watching a movie on a television on your computer, a reality that hits home when a bunch of flying phalluses and pornographic clowns burst into your SL living room and totally ruin the experience of watching Lord of the Rings for the 12th time on a screen the size of a postcard. Some people even have business meetings in SL. No wonder capitalism is in free fall. When Second Lifers complained about griefers disrupting a conference, one griefer blogger responded, quote, some of the victims, I use quotes because nobody can be a victim for hearing a joke or participating in one, say that we interrupt business meetings. A business meeting? In a game? Unquote. I never thought I'd agree with what may turn out to be mildly sociopathic talking genitalia, but I guess that's what the world has come to. Matter of fact, seems to me this is the mildly sociopathic talking genitalia's world. We just live in it. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Minella Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2008.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Special thanks to Kadar Lawrence, Arnie Warshaw, Stephanie Weissman, Diana Rathbone, Also, thanks to Dan Brandon, Zoe Corneli, Merle Kessler, and Corey Goldman.
Our production coordinator is Devin Strolovich. Daniel Elstein is our director of research, and Lael Weiss is our webmaster.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and from Powell City of Books. Support also comes from the Templeton Foundation.
And from the members of KALW, Local Public Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.